What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. Today I have a great lineup. First, I speak to Eva Putsova, a former Flagstaff City Council member who helped raise the minimum wage, and progressive Democrat running for Congress in Arizona's 1st District on Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, and no more wars. Then I speak to Brent Welder, a member of the DNC Rules Committee and a former congressional candidate for Kansas's District 3. And then we're joined by Breonna Joy Gray, a journalist and former press secretary for Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, who argues that litmus tests are extremely important and should be applied to Joe Biden. Please rate and review the show on iTunes. Also, become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, it's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. This week's Patreon-only episode is a continuation of my chat with Breonna Joy Gray and Brent Weldner, as well as a great discussion with Jack Allison, co-host of the Struggle Session podcast, and happy 3-year anniversary to them. Also the host of Jack AM, a show on Twitch. Eva Putsova's race is August 4th, so if you're listening to this on August 4th, make sure you spread the word, check out her campaign. Also, I just want to give some shout-outs to other people who are running for office and are progressive, and that includes Cori Bush, Kara Eastman, Rashida Tlaib, Jen Perlman, Rebecca Parsons, Solomon Rajput. So, Eva Putsova, welcome to the show, and tell us why you are running for Congress in Arizona's 1st District.
Yes, thank you so very much for having me, and hello, everybody. Yes, this is my first time on Katie's show, and it's very exciting. So, I'm running in Arizona's 1st Congressional District because, frankly, the current congressman has failed to champion people's issues, and he has time and time over-prioritized corporations over people, whether it comes to healthcare, climate change, immigration, or any number of issues. It's clear that we need new leadership, and actually we need people who are not going to be bought by corporate interests and who have political courage, and that's why I'm running for this seat.
And you're actually part of Matriarch. You've been endorsed by Matriarch, right? Which is this kind of a Emily's List alternative.
Yes. Matriarch.
And we had Nomiki Konst on the other day, and she's, of course, a board member. And they, I think, exist to basically fund women who are progressive who aren't already extremely rich so that people can run for office and even win without having their own, the exorbitant amount of money needed.
Yeah, Matriarch PAC has been a great supporting organization. We have a number of other organizations that have supported us, and it is their encouragement and kind of a community of candidates that they support that allows us to exchange experiences and just kind of build on each other's knowledge as we run these campaigns, which are complex, difficult, and of course, you know, require money. And we are raising every single dollar from individual donors. We take absolutely no corporate PACs, and we have not taken actually any political action committees PACs, not even those that are not tied to corporations.
And tell us about your opponent and how long has he been a Democrat?
My opponent, he's a co-chair of Blue Dogs. He is has been a lifelong Republican. I should say he was lifelong Republican until he decided to run for Congress in this congressional district one, because this district tends to vote for Democrats. So he switched parties in 2016 or for the 2016 election, got elected to Congress, and then voted with Trump 54% of the time in that first term.
Wow. Better than Josh Gottheimer, I guess, who's voted with him for over 70. But that should not be the bar, being better than one of the worst members of Congress, the most reactionary Trump-loving members of Congress. So your opponent is up there. And tell us what made you consider running.
So after the 2008 crisis, it became clear that our government bailed out corporations and wealthy, and the regular people were left behind. I ran for the local city council here in Flagstaff, Arizona in 2014 because I wanted to make a difference at the local level. And my top issue on which I ran was to raise the minimum wage, local minimum wage in Flagstaff. And because I didn't have the votes on the city council, and for the first 2 years, it was quite a conservative majority on the council. I ran a local citizen initiative through which we raised the minimum wage in Flagstaff to $15.50 per hour. And also we raised the sub-minimum tipped wage. Of course, as you know, throughout those 4 years and as you're serving locally and dealing with all of the local issues, it becomes clear that there are so many issues that the local government doesn't have the jurisdiction over, like immigration. And it became clear that even on issues like healthcare or climate change, what we really need is a leadership at the federal level. And that's why I'm running. I support Medicare for All. I support the Green New Deal. I want to see a complete immigration overhaul. And importantly, in this district, it's so important that we finally start prioritizing the interests of the indigenous people of this country who have been neglected, pushed to the very edge of the society, and it's time that we put first people first.
What's your life story? How did you get involved in politics?
I grew up in Slovakia. Everybody can tell that I'm an immigrant. I was 12 years old in 1989, and so that year kind of formed me as a political human being and instilled in me the ideals of democracy and justice and equality. And so that kind of makes me always think about, you know, what we're doing in this country and how our own government does things that are the same things that a totalitarian government would do. We see that in Portland, right, in Oregon, with Trump's administration. I mean, sending federal agents on your own people, that's exactly what KGB, Stasi, or, you know, in Czechoslovakia, it was STB that they did to their own people. I came to the U.S. because first I wanted to learn the language and just be immersed in the culture. I ended up immigrating kind of accidentally because my partner at the time had college debt and I was free. I got my college education completely paid by taxpayers in Slovakia. And I was free to move, maybe not financially well off, but I was at least able to move wherever I wanted. Okay. So that's how I ended up in the United States. And then, you know, I was always been very active as, you know, as a child growing up. And ultimately, you know, you don't change as a person. And so my parents were quite active. My father was a chair of a kind of county's Democratic Party in the post 1989 Slovakia. And my mother was a local union leader. She was a teacher. And so she led a local union, teachers union.
Great. And tell us what is happening in your where you are, and especially to everyone, but also especially to the indigenous people in terms of COVID and the rates there.
So the tribal communities have been ignored for decades and decades, really just centuries, right? First, it wasn't just being ignored. I mean, the government tried to annihilate them and, you know, displace them, dislocate them. And because of all the issues we have, like on the Navajo Nation, for example, 30% of people don't have running water. 15,000 households don't have electricity. And hundreds of miles of roads are unpaved. And we have not invested in the indigenous communities' healthcare or education. And so these shortages in all these areas just exacerbate the problem that was brought by the pandemic. And it hit the reservation very hard. And people are dying, and they're being hospitalized at a much higher rate, completely unnecessary, because of all those official policies of discrimination and the lack of interest in prioritizing fixing of this very basic infrastructure.
And what is the population where you live, where you're, that you're representing? What kind of demographics are there?
So Arizona's first congressional district is one of the largest. I think it's the 11th largest in the district. And it has the largest Native American population of any district in the country. 25% of all people who reside within the district boundaries are Native Americans. There are actually 13 different tribes. So it's quite diverse population. This district politically leans Democratic. We've had a Democrat elected to Congress every single time since last redistricting, and by a larger margin. So the question really is not about flipping the district. The question is what kind of Democrat we're going to send to Washington, D.C. And I do believe that people are fed up with representatives who are bought by corporate interests. And we have to not only change the policies, of course, we have to change those, but we have to change the rules of politics. And we have to actually elect people who want to see regular people to do well, and not those ultra wealthy few, or just those ultra wealthy few. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be taken
And so the population that's not to sound like a eugenicist or something, but the population that is not indigenous, what are they?
So, it is still a majority white population in this district. We have a Latino population that's sizable as well, and, very small Black community. But those are, again, it's the Native population that dominates. We probably have 20, maybe up to 25% of a Latino community. So that's, immigration is a big issue in Arizona and certainly in this district. And, we've seen ICE raids and just how incredibly cruel, inhumane our immigration system is.
Part of why I asked is I was wondering if there are attempts by either your opponent or Republicans or conservatives or people in general, politicians, to kind of divide and conquer, to like turn different groups against each other.
Well, what I've heard from the establishment, and this is all on Democratic side, is, they're selling people fear. It's like, oh, we have to be, this district cannot elect a progressive.
Right.
We have to vote for O'Halloran, he's the incumbent, because in a way that's the best we can do. It's not that they even support him because of the policies that he promotes or the votes that he casts. It's because, that's the best. We worry about losing the seat, right, as if the seat didn't belong to people, as if, You know, I think this is the problem that we have in today's world when, you know, it's either one party or the other party. Sometimes we hear about this whole wonderful bipartisanship when what we really need is to thinking about transpartisanship, thinking right. about what's good for the people and stop talking about these seats as if they belong to a party.
Right. Part of like a dynasty. Bill Clinton the other day, speaking at John Lewis's funeral, and he thanked James Clyburn, who was in the audience, for, with the stroke of a hand, ending the intra-family party war or something. I mean, we know that that happened. We know that the Clintons wanted Bernie to be destroyed, defeated, but it was just such entitlement to hear him say that out loud.
Mm-hmm. And also at the funeral, you know, during eulogy.
Yeah.
We have essentially two parties that, you know, are run by the same corporate interests. People like to say, oh, this candidate puts people's interests over party's interests, but that's not usually true. They just support corporations, and that has to end. Like, how do we want to overturn Citizens United when we continue elect the same people who benefit from dark money?
And it's really cool because your website, if you go to your website, you have a list of COVID-19 resources like at the top of the page. How has that changed the way you're running and the election?
So this district, because it's so large, it's probably the COVID-19 crisis has not changed our tactics too much. We knew that we cannot, win by just canvassing. I mean, we have been canvassing and knocking on the doors before the pandemic because we started this campaign very early, knowing that, of course, the best way to reach people is to reach them at their doors and talk to them in person. But that's not really a sustainable strategy to win in this giant district when it takes 8 hours to drive from north to south. And so in a way, this COVID-19 forced us to be very focused, really preserve some of our resources and energy. You know, we've been calling voters, texting voters, and of course, you know, we've been trying to raise money to support the entire campaign, because you cannot run a successful campaign without decent budget. You know, we don't need gazillion dollars like these corporate candidates. They raise so much and then they spend it quickly on, you know, in areas where one can argue it's complete waste.
Right. I love the issues, because you're Medicare for All, First People First, which is your program for Indigenous people. Tuition-free college, workers' rights, LGBTQ rights, a Green New Deal, reproductive health, immigration overhaul, but also you got no more wars.
Absolutely. I think it's very important for us Americans to realize the power we have in the world. And, you know, we have to be careful with that power. We've been now in wars for 17 years. And I just think it's incredible, you know, the amount of resources when you think about that we spend on these wars and the terror that, you know, those wars then inflict on those local communities outside of this country. And at the same time, the vulnerabilities that we have are inside, you know, in the United States. I mean, that's the national, if we really care about national security,
right.
If we really care, then we start looking at our utilities, at our electric grid, at data, and as we have seen with this COVID-19, at public health. That's a huge, huge vulnerability that we are not able as a country to control the spread of the virus.
Yeah. And I know, and it would be great if the Democrats were actually responding to what people want, like Medicare for All, instead of just being kind of low-key Trumpian about this, or just running on not being as evil as Trump. One more question. I don't know if you have time. Do you have time for one more question?
One more, yeah.
Okay. So have you encountered, I don't know where most people assume that you're from, but have you encountered any like Russophobia?
Yes, you know, for I clearly have an Eastern European accent, and for most people, you know, that is, we're all Russians. And, you know, I think that just reflects how media talks about Russia. You know, we're not talking about Putin's administration, right? But we are talking about oftentimes in the mainstream media about the Russians, and we are demonizing entire group of people, and the public then gets the message that, you know, people from this part of the world are bad, and then everybody who sounds like they are from Eastern Europe, who could in their mind be Russians, they're you know, painted as somebody who's bad. And you know, Russian people are not bad. There's nothing wrong. There is no group of people that are bad. They can have a horrible administration, horrible government. In the United States, Trump's administration is horrible, but I don't think anybody would say that Americans are bad. And so, maybe.
You can find some people, but yeah.
Maybe, that's a reality. I mean, you know, we are all humans, and so we project on others all kinds of biases and thoughts. But you know, on the other hand, it's also something that can start the conversation. You know, my accent oftentimes is the reason why people want to talk to me. So,
And how is it manifested? Do people just say, is it? Are they judgmental of you? Do they call you?
They have a negative connotation because of that accent, because of my accent. Sometimes. I shouldn't generalize it. Yeah. It just, I encountered a few of those negative connotation, like, oh, she sounds Russian, and then immediately tying me to Russian bots or, you know, Putin, and, you know, like, it's all... you know, because of the impression we created.
Sure,
and it's not just, you know, the recent, right? But it's also, you know, we cannot forget 40 years of Cold War, right?
James Bond.
that continues.
Right. And, but thank you so much. And what else do you want to make sure people know? Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, I just would like to invite everybody to follow us, of course, on Twitter. And visit our website, evaforcongress.com. We have two precious days to make a difference. And if you can join our volunteers, there's a volunteer sign up on our website as well. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you.
Thanks so much. And that was Eva Putsova. She is a progressive Democrat running for Congress in Arizona's 1st District. You can follow her on Twitter at Eva Putsova. That's EvaPutzova. Go to her website, Eva for Congress. Now I talk to Brent Welder. Brent Welder is a former congressional candidate. He ran in Kansas's 3rd District. He also was appointed to the DNC Rules Committee by Bernie Sanders.
4 years ago, I put forth an amendment to the platform committee that Bernie had nominated me to say that as a party, we should stand for getting money entirely out of politics. Didn't go well. In fact, they had a corporate lobbyist was the first person to speak against my amendment, which at the time I thought was hilarious and was probably some sort of terrible, terrible mistake, right? This time around, Bernie nominated me to the Rules Committee, and I put forth an amendment to say that the DNC should reject corporate PAC money and ban lobbyists from serving on the DNC. And what do you know? The first person they found to speak against it was a corporate lobbyist. And the way that I know is because he talked about it during his speech. So, you know, I don't know whether they just literally cannot find somebody that's not a corporate lobbyist on these committees to speak against it. I don't know whether they think that's some kind of good messaging for them. But then they used corrupt tactics and rigged voting to try to sink my anti-corruption amendment so that there was no record of the vote. So
So they wanted to show and not tell.
Exactly.
Actually not show the corruption, but not show what actually happened. So, can you explain that a little bit more?
Of course.
Break that down. Yeah.
So, you know, I ran for Congress in 2018 here in Kansas, and I was actually the one that came up with the no corporate PAC money pledge that everybody has heard so much about from probably hundreds, if not thousands, of candidates at all level of government. It's a big issue for me, something I've been an activist on for a long time. And so when Bernie nominated me to the Rules Committee for the DNC this time, I wanted to continue to try to root corruption out of the DNC, which there's a lot of it to root out. And and this meeting, they used the COVID-19 tragedy for their own political gain in a way to make the meetings even more rigged and scripted than they ever have been before. So much so that those of us on the committee weren't even able technologically to talk to the chairman of the committee, because they stuck all of us in this separate room. And the only way they would even turn your mic on to talk to the chairman or to go over the live stream was if they, you know, graced you with the ability, if you were literally in the script that was already scripted out beforehand, right? Well, so then they, and through all these other heavy-handed tactics, they got all the progressives to, you know, withdraw a whole bunch of amendments, all this kind of stuff. So they were just going one by one. You know, a Bernie person would put up an amendment, they'd vote it down, they'd move on to the next one, there'd be a new amendment, they'd vote it down, they'd move on to the next one. Well, I had been contacted by kind of an intermediary from the Biden campaign before the meeting, saying that the Biden campaign was particularly pissed off about my particular amendments to stop corporate PAC money and ban corporate lobbyists. I was asked to, you know, withdraw them. I politely declined to do so. And when they got to my amendment, I expected them to do what they had done to the others. Let me present it. Let me give my speech, vote it down, move on to the next one. However, what they did was I did my speech. They opened up voting. So I went over to the voting machine or voting device that they give us, which had been working perfectly fine throughout the entire meeting. Of course, I wanted to vote yes on my own amendment. I what do you know? It wasn't working. Kept checking back. As this lobbyist is droning on, I'm checking back. It's not working. It's not working. At the time, I just thought, well, maybe it really is just some kind of technical error. All of a sudden, the lobbyist makes a motion to table my amendment, which, you know, I'm no parliamentary procedure expert. I really didn't exactly know what the ramifications of that would be. Are they tabling it till like next convention 4 years from now? What on earth is this? Well, but luckily they had, and then all of a sudden they start voting on this tabling motion in the middle of what was supposed to be the vote on my amendment, which I'm not sure that that's even proper. However, they accidentally left my microphone on for the live stream. And so I was able to immediately start protesting that and saying, this makes no sense. What are we doing here? Tabling until when? Why don't we just have an up and down vote? Immediately after I did that, Barney Frank, who's the chairman, who's on the board of a big bank, he explained that, you know, tabling means that if there is no successful motion to untable at any point, it's going to die with the committee, which was going to be 15 minutes later. Then they immediately shoved me back in this room. They realized their mistake. They left my microphone on. I get into the room with all the Biden and Bernie, you know, the virtual room with all the Biden and Bernie committee people, and the 50 Bernie members are going berserk. Talk about how unfair it is, trying to call for a motion to untable it, although obviously it's falling on literally deaf ears because they can't hear them. And there was so much pushback, and it was just sustained at that point forward for the next like 10 minutes as they continued to try to do the business of the committee, that ultimately at the end, first the chairperson said they were going to end the meeting. And then all of a sudden they say, oh, wait, we actually, I guess they got enough pressure that they decided to have a vote to untable it. That miraculously won for one reason or another. I think literally because the Biden committee members knew how corrupt and terrible it looked. But then ultimately, of course, they voted down my amendment. Yeah. So that's how that all played out.
That's kind of the perfect metaphor, right? They give you like the illusion of democracy or fairness, just like on something this big. And then ultimately, though, they deprive you of it. I saw you. It's funny. I reached out. We were talking about having you on. And then after that, I saw you on Jimmy Dore.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, Jimmy is like, he gets so much crap and he really knows his stuff. Like he was explaining. I was like, what is he talking about? All these rules. He's like, you knew that Obama was going to do that. He passed this. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, but it's very elucidating and enlightening. But he was getting, you know, and I got to say, this is feeling more and more appealing to me. And it's funny because most of my guests don't think this, but the whole, like, why even bother? What are we doing by not just like voting for Biden, but saying we're voting for Biden? Is that at all strategic? And it's actually my guest later on. It's perfect because she wrote this piece called In Defense of Litmus Test, which argues that blue, no matter who ism, actually is not just like morally bankrupt, but is hurting the chances of, you know, pushing. Obviously, it's hurting the chances of pushing Biden to the left, but ultimately probably of defeating Trump. So the question there is, what's the plan now?
Well, I mean, and, you know, that's a really good point. So, you know, one thing that I keep hearing among the more establishment folks, or even just honestly well-meaning voters, when they've been seeing all of this situation kind of first blow up, and then I've been on, you know, invited on a number of podcasts to talk about it and stuff, is they say, well, you know, don't we really, you know, we really need that corporate PAC money. Let's just use it to get Trump out. And then, you know, maybe we can, you know, ban it after that. But there's two problems with that. One is every single 4 years that we hate the Republican, right? They don't get any better. The other thing, though, is that the obvious point that by banning the corporate influence and the lobbyists and the bad money, it actually will make our chances better for winning the election, which I don't know why they can't get that through their minds. I mean, you know, the example that I actually go back to is Donald Trump himself. Hillary had twice the amount of money as he did, right? But clearly, with the American people, his message resonated more. He was kind of like a truth teller without the truth. But if you don't have a truth teller with the truth to counteract the truth teller without the truth, and if they don't trust our nominee, then they're not going to vote for us, and our chances of winning are going to go down dramatically. And there's no amount of money. And it was proven in 2016. She had hundreds of millions of dollars. What, a half a billion dollars more than him, whatever it was. And he is a clown. He is a jackass. And he was even less credible then than he is now. He was a joke, right? And we couldn't even beat the biggest joke on the face of the earth in an election, because they don't trust us. They don't trust the Democratic Party. And so, you know, we don't need their corporate money. Quite the opposite. We need to reject the money. And then we can start not only winning elections, but then not have corrupt government officials, so we can actually start solving all these problems that are getting worse and worse and worse and worse. You know, now under COVID, a million times worse than it was before.
Now, in this segment, Brianna Joy Gray joins me and Brent Welder. Well, this is Brianna Joy Gray, everyone, and former Bernie Sanders press secretary, former Intercept political editor, and now with Current Affairs. And she wrote a great piece called In Defense of Litmus Test, and that deals with a lot of what we're talking about. And you argue that, you know, it's not helping the Dems defeat Trump to not push Biden to the left.
Yeah, I think the crucial observation, I think that everyone who is a leftist, who identified with progressive movements, the Bernie campaign, and much broader than that, is that there is the subtext to everyone who tells us that we need to stop pushing Biden, the subtext to everyone who tells us that we're somehow voting for Trump if we levy any criticism in Biden's direction, is that if Biden were to concede to the demands of the left, and which are in fact the demands of the overwhelming majority of Democrats, and in many cases, the majority of Americans, regardless of political party, that it would somehow disadvantage him in the general election contest, right? So the push is to say, don't say anything at all about Biden because you are enabling Trump's victory by doing so. But the reality is, when you look at the fact that when you go down policy proposal after policy proposal, prescription after prescription, that overwhelming majorities of people actually want Biden to do those things, then it becomes clear that the issue, the factor that is skewing the election for Trump, is not in fact us asking for these basic things from Biden, but Biden's refusal to acquiesce. And so if we are to raise these issues and Biden chooses not to respond by embracing these overwhelmingly popular policies, the onus is on him in the general election. But what they're doing is flipping the script and pretending that we live in a world where we're asking for radical, bizarre things that would somehow disadvantage him. And in doing so, they're able to silence what is an overwhelming supermajority of Americans who are living through a time of unprecedented crisis, frankly, where the need for things like Medicare for all, decriminalization of marijuana have never been more obvious. And so I think it's incumbent on all of us to start shifting that burden and being really clear about the fact that what we're asking for is in fact for Biden to position himself better against Trump by drawing stronger contrasts and advocating for the policies that average Americans want.
That's the most sensible thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Honestly, I mean, God.
And to that point, I mean, do you think that, I think people have like understandable PTSD from Trump's win, even people who are very critical of Biden from the left and were Bernie people. But I think some people have like internalized guilt as if it's their fault for supporting the candidate who would have won. I think obviously we don't know, but I always thought that he was more electable than Hillary Clinton. Not always. Once he started running and went from 3% name recognition or whatever he started at. But I think a lot of people, like you say, they automatically concede or prematurely have conceded their support, and they kind of announce it. And you, Bree, you have an amazing, you recall this amazing moment where Elizabeth Warren was at the debates, and she said, I'd like to talk about who we're running against, a billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. And then you say it was a sharp and effective volley, but the impact was dimmed somewhat by the disclaimer uttered in the same breath. Quote, I'll support whoever the Democratic nominee is, end quote. So yeah. What is that, people feeling pressure? Is that their genuine belief that they really need to say that? And again, it's like, even if you think that that's what's going to happen, even if you're prepared to vote blue, no matter who, why are people advertising it?
Right. So this gets down to this question of leverage. And for the average voter, the consequences, the positioning of people who are in Congress is a little bit different than the average voter.
Right.
Literally, the only leverage we have in the world is our vote. And that example was particularly important to me because that occurred. The fidelity pledge to vote blue no matter who, even if it were Michael Bloomberg, was extracted from people, from voters and candidates alike, so long before it was anything near an inevitability that Michael Bloomberg would be in the race. So by conceding so early that you would be willing to vote for a candidate like that, you're basically accepting, you're putting out into the world that voters should consider him to be a legitimate, viable Democratic candidate, which from my perspective, he should never have been. He is someone who was a Republican until recently and who wasn't just a Republican in name, as though that's like fundamentally toxic in and of itself, but the policies that he supported were conservative. He is the poster child for a racially motivated stop and frisk policy in New York City, in New York City, but what makes him maligned across the state and beyond for anybody who ever had the misfortune of having to exist here as a Black and brown person in a certain age bracket. You know, I've witnessed my brother be stopped and frisked during the time period as someone who moved to New York as a teenager in 2001. So, you know, the idea that now we're in the middle of a massive movement for Black lives where criminal justice reform is front and center on the minds of millions of Americans. We had people plausibly discussing Michael Bloomberg as a candidate was incredibly bizarre, especially when we had so many eligible, exciting candidates at play. And so imagine a world in which all of the rest of the candidates had been united in their response and said, frankly, I don't think that Michael Bloomberg deserves to be on this stage. Frankly, I don't think that he should be in any way considered to be a legitimate representative of the Democratic Party. But by not doing so, Democrats increasingly allow their brand to be co-opted and shift us farther and farther to the right. And every year, and this is something I argue in the piece, every year Democrats say that we are up against the most fascistic, right-wing, threatening Republican candidate in our lives. And the fact of the matter is, more often than not, they're right. But there's a reason why we are always in this position. And it's because we never outline any kind of floor, any kind of barrier, any kind of litmus test that should satisfy Democratic voters before they're willing to throw their vote at just anyone. And the consequence of that is that we go farther and farther and farther to the right, because the literal floor of the Democratic Party is just a hair's breadth above Donald Trump's head. And that's not where we should be. It's not where we need to be. And in fact, I think by doing that, by allowing Joe Biden to run and ignore policies and also make choices like having so many corporate lobbyists, healthcare lobbyists, et cetera, so close to him in his senior advisor team, he's opening himself up to criticisms that are going to be legitimate from Trump that we've seen him leverage at Hillary Clinton in 2016. And also he's abandoning a whole suite of policy proposals that could get him the kind of excitement, volunteer base, investment, donor base, that's a non-corporate, non-super PAC donor base that Bernie Sanders enjoyed and would in fact make him a more electable candidate. So in my view, the people who are enabling Trump, the people who are making it easier for him to win and harder for Biden are the folks that are holding Biden to such a low, low standard.
And, you know, if I can pitch in here, the types of voters that the Democrats would win if they were taking Brianna's advice are probably exactly the types that people would be least likely to expect. I say that as somebody from Kansas, where is a very populist state. In fact, it was the birth of the populist movement.
Yeah.
The very voters that actually we can win with, you know, for instance, economic populist ideas are the ones that voted very fervently for Donald Trump. You know, frankly, a lot of them voted for Obama and then Trump. A lot of them maybe didn't even vote for Obama and voted for Trump. But if they have one candidate who agrees with them on the social issues and another candidate who doesn't agree, who doesn't really stand for anything, they're going to every time go to the one with the social issues. But if you give them an alternative of somebody that agrees with them on their pocketbook, especially right now during a recession that's headed to a depression, we can absolutely win those voters. And it's not, you know, yes, you know, it's not the idea of the swing voter completely changes, because are we going to win a bunch of like corporate Republicans, maybe a few of whom crossed over to vote for Hillary that way? No, maybe we'll even lose some of their votes, but we'll win. There's so many overwhelmingly more of the populist voters than there are of the 1% voters that we can get and attract if we, you know, were to take her advice.
Yeah.
And what's so frustrating is I think a lot about this and why it is that there's this misunderstanding about what it means to get a swing voter. You know, in this kind of, there's this expectation that if you are attractive to a certain kind of white working class voter, that it must be because you are throwing the Democratic base under the bus, as it were.
Women, people of color, LGBTQ people, right? That's
exactly,
the narrative.
Yeah. Exactly. And I understand why that narrative exists, because historically that has been the way that a certain kind of white voter has been solicited. But yeah, that kind of voter isn't the voter, you know. What is happening is that corporate Democrats are willing to concede to cuts in Social Security, are willing to downplay a whole host of social issues that are enormously important to historically marginalized groups in order to go after an affluent white moderate voter, the voter that Chuck Schumer famously said in 2016 we're going to get in Connecticut or what have you. But on the other hand, when you're reaching out for voters who have an overwhelming overlap of interests with historically marginalized voters, because so many of the ways that historical discrimination is manifest is through these economic ways, right? And the inability to stay housed and afford rent, and inability to access social programs, and, you know, all of these healthcare. You know, when you're able to attract people by actually reaching for those material goals, you don't have to start throwing anybody in the bus. You actually just have to fulfill what the original promise that the Democratic Party was supposed to be, which is to be this party of labor and this party of the people. But I do want to acknowledge that there are reasonable historical reasons why a lot of Democrats are skeptical and frustrated by this idea that you know, we can reach out to this working class white voter, because for so long that rhetoric has been a dog whistle. But we cannot allow those bad actors to strip away our ability to talk about working class voters who are, in fact, overwhelmingly female and non-white, right? We can't allow them to appropriate that language and then inhibit our ability to speak to the base that is, in fact, the base, this beautiful working class, diverse working class base that is, in fact, additionally comprised of white working class Americans. And we can't, you know, the Field Sisters talk a lot about this in Racecraft, and this idea that we are helping to reify these racial group, this kind of racialized balkanization along political lines, by talking about Trump as a president for white people, and then talking about Democrats as the candidates for people of color, without kind of acknowledging the larger amount of nuance there, and saying Trump is the candidate for affluent people who are overwhelmingly white, and Democrats should be the party for working class people who are disproportionately non-white, but also do a lot of good for any white voters who are feeling understandably neglected by the Republican Party.
And I was I think I was the first one to introduce the topic of a swing voter in this conversation. But, you know, I would be remiss to not point out that there are, what, 100 million people that did not vote in the last presidential election. And I guarantee you, by definition, most of them are not in the 1%. Almost right. All of them are in the 99%. Right. Yeah. And there are so exorbitantly many more of these non-voters than there are any amount of swing voters. You know, also often they are in the classes of people that feel, for good reason, because they're absolutely right, that they have absolutely no voice whatsoever. And if we were even just the party that just made them feel like they had a voice, or made them feel like they could trust anything that our leaders have to say whatsoever, I feel like they would flock to support our candidates, even if they disagreed with us on various issues or not. You know, that's by far the key to success, I think, as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to the Katie Halper Show. Don't forget to become Patreon subscribers, and you'll be able to access more of my chat with Brent Weldner and Brianna Joy Gray, as well as my chat with Jack Allison, co-host of Struggle Session podcast and the Twitch show, Jack AM.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.